All right. Acts chapter 26. That is where we are. We left off. You remember Paul now is giving a defense before King Agrippa. And we understand, of course, we kind of refer to it as a defense. It's what he's been doing, but this isn't a real trial. He's already appealed to Caesar, so he's going to stand before Caesar. But Agrippa is kind of curious. Remember, Festus was telling him all that was going on with Paul, and so that struck his curiosity, and he requested that he be able to speak with Paul or hear Paul. And then, of course, Paul was excited to do that because King Agrippa was one who was very familiar with all the customs and the laws of the prophets with regard to the Jews. And so Paul was glad to do that. And we have been studying the last couple of weeks then that defense before King Agrippa. And he begins by emphasizing his hope, the hope that he has based upon the prophets. It is basically the hope of the resurrection. And then he went through his conversion again, proving the resurrection. After he talked about Christ being raised from the dead, he felt like he needed to verify that, and he did so through and by his own experience. And so he talked about his conversion, the scene of Christ, the resurrected Christ on the road to Damascus, and so on. And so he has emphasized that. And as he was speaking to Agrippa, you remember where we left off last week, that Festus kind of interrupted Paul and said that he was, the King James says, you are mad. The ESV might be a little bit more dramatic there. He said that you're out of your mind. And then after we kind of talked about that a little bit. But we closed, actually, I was emphasizing Paul's response. That's the impressive thing. And that's the thing that I think even today we need to learn from as Christians, of how we respond when people don't treat us exactly the right way, or even particularly as we get in religious conversations with people, that there are going to be a lot of people that have a negative response to what we teach. When we really teach the unperverted gospel of Christ, people might call you narrow-minded. People might ridicule the church, or you're a part of a cult, or whatever it might be. There are all kinds of responses that we have gotten through the years. Or it might be just you in a personal Bible study, maybe sitting around your kitchen table with somebody, and it gets a little bit heated. And you know what they say about you want to get in a heated argument, politics and religion, that will probably do it. And when there's a disagreement, people feel passionately about those issues. And when you have to deal with people and talk with them about maybe they're caught up in some false doctrine or some false religion or false church, and sooner or later you try to be as polite and kind as you can be, but sooner or later the dots have to be connected, and sometimes people get upset. And so the question is, how do we respond to that? And I was saying as we closed last week, if you find yourself in that kind of discussion, and if it ever gets to the point where it's very negative and there's a heated exchange and that sort of thing, and an argument going back and forth, it becomes real fiery, then most of the time, maybe not all the time, depends on who you're dealing with, obviously, but most of the time when you get in that situation, the chance of conversion is very slim. When you get in a back and forth kind of heated argument, if there's any fire taking place, you want it to come from the other side. And you want to be calm and collective and level-minded as you're dealing with people. And Paul was like that. And Paul taught us to be like that. Turn over to 2 Peter, just 2 Timothy, just for a minute. And I remember what Paul, 2 Timothy chapter 2, I believe it is. Paul was dealing with this sort of thing as he was talking to Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 2, and look down, about verse 24. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24, he says, "And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome." And of course, we're all the Lord's servants. And we should be serving the Lord. All of us should be doing the best we can to have Bible studies and teach other people about Christ. We're all the Lord's servant. But he says, as we go about doing that, the Lord's servant should not be quarrelsome. And watch what he says. But kind to everyone. That should be our nature. Now, let's not forget, we're Christians. And as Christians, we ought to just be kind by nature. We ought to be at least developing kindness. And this is what he says, particularly when you're trying to help people to come to Christ or to be saved. He says, you be kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring evil. And that puts me right back in mind and back over there now. I'll finish that reading there in 2 Timothy 2. But back over here in chapter 26, here it is, Festus interrupting Paul, basically. It's not even like that, you know, they were going back and forth from the standpoint that Paul was saying something and then it was Festus' turn. He's given a defense. He's basically preaching the gospel to Agrippa and his sister Bernice and the people standing by, and Festus interrupts with a loud voice. He yells out, "You're out of your mind." It's a natural reaction when you're in that kind of situation to respond negatively. But you know, Paul is pretty experienced at this thing now. We've seen him all through the book of Acts and all of these journeys that he's been on, the first, second, and third journeys, and we've seen him engaged in different kinds of situations where he's pretty well trained. He knows how to respond to people. And we need to do the same thing. It's not always a natural reaction, but we need to think about how we're coming across and how we're dealing, how we're treating the people that we're trying to win to Christ. And so here's Festus, right? And just yells out, interrupts Paul, yells out, "You're out of your mind." And how does he respond? He says, "I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus." And he compliments him. And then you think back over here at 2 Timothy. No wonder Paul could write this in 2 Timothy to Timothy, because he practiced the very thing. But he says to Timothy then, you patiently endure evil, correcting his opponents, that is the servant of the Lord, correcting his opponents with gentleness, that God may perhaps grant them repentance leading to a knowledge of the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil after being captured by him and to do his will. See, we always have to remember what we're doing, even in a Bible study. It's not about winning an argument. You're not trying to impress anybody or the one that you're studying with. You're in that thing because you want that individual to come to repentance. You're trying to help that individual escape the snare of the devil. And you have to always remember that. So that person may get upset. You can even kind of predict that. You know, some of the things, again, for those of you, or most of you, are members of the church, and you, some of the things we have to get into when we're in a home Bible study is sensitive stuff. You have to tell people, maybe someone grew up in a religion that they feel strongly about. Their parents are a part of that religion. Their grandparents are a part of that religion. And now you're trying to teach them by the Word of God, the unperverted gospel, and you have to be patient with people. And you have to be gentle. And you have to endure a little evil sometimes. They may yell at you. They may get angry. But you might win them to Christ just by your demeanor. Just by you not yelling back. Remaining level-headed. Just the way Paul did. And that's what he's saying to Timothy, the young evangelist. You make sure, as a servant of the Lord, that's how you act. And that's how we should act. And watch this. Go back over to Acts chapter 26 and notice the rest of this. Here's Paul again. We see how he responds to this. You're out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you out of your mind. And Paul said, "I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words." And the word rational there is the Greek word there. Basically points to sanity, sane words. And so he's counteracting what Festus is saying. "No, I'm not out of my mind. Basically Festus was saying, you've gone mad. You're insane." No, he says in a calm way, after complimenting him, "Most excellent Festus, I'm not out of my mind. I'm speaking rationally, sanely." And now watch what he does. He says, "For the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly, for I am persuaded that none of these things have escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner." Now you see just another little tip here. What Paul does is he kind of gets out of that situation. He moves on. He doesn't get into a back and forth with Festus, which he could have. And again, some of that is a natural reaction. "You're out of your mind, Paul." "No, you're out of your mind." "No, you don't want to do that, do you?" And you don't even want to continue engaged. He just moves the conversation along. He defends himself and says, "No, complimentary, most excellent Festus, I'm not out of my mind. I'm speaking rational words." And he gets going again. And so he diffuses that sort of situation. And he points out that the things that he is saying, again, he now begins to focus back on King Agrippa. And he says, "For I'm persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner." In other words, the things that he's quoting prophets and that sort of thing. And with reference to Christ and all that Christ did, Christ didn't operate in a secretive manner. In fact, turn over in the book of John. Jesus himself, when he was dealing with Pilate, remember he was engaged with Pilate. I believe it's chapter 19. Let's go over to John chapter 19. And this is before that. He's dealing with the high priest here at verse 19 of chapter 18. So a little bit before he's dealing with Pilate. In John 18 at verse 19, it says, "The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching." And so they, of course, all of this is illegitimate. They don't care anything about Jesus. They don't care anything about truth. They're trying to trap Jesus and all of that. But the high priest begins to question him about his doctrine, about his disciples and teaching. And Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said." And of course that upset upset one of the officers standing there, and he struck Jesus. But the point is, Jesus said, I haven't done anything in secret. And this is what Paul now is saying in his defense as he's talking to King Agrippa and Festus and the rest of them there. He brings out all of these things that I'm preaching. You should be aware of. He had confidence, at least King Agrippa, who was familiar with the Jews and what had gone on, that he was familiar with these things. And so he says, again, "I'm persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you believe." And so here's the situation. Paul at least believed that Agrippa, who was familiar with the prophets, that he accepted what the prophets had taught. He believed. Here's another case where we learn believing is not enough. Agrippa believed, but that certainly was not enough. Paul, at least, was persuaded that King Agrippa believed, and it appears by his response that he did. It says, "King Agrippa, do you believe? I know that you believe." And Agrippa said to Paul, "In a short time, would you persuade me to be a Christian?" And I still like the King James. The ESV here almost reads as if he's questioning Paul about that, but the King James, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." And that is really to the point. That is really what Agrippa is doing. Agrippa, in other words, is real close to obeying the gospel of Christ. Paul basically has made a threefold defense in all of this. He has talked about the resurrection of Christ. He's emphasized his own conversion. He has talked about the prophets and what the prophets have said, and Agrippa was one who understood the prophets. And so Agrippa says, you almost got me. You've almost persuaded me to be a Christian. But we have pointed out many times before, this is just one of those things with regard to Christianity and being saved. Almost isn't good enough, is it? And this really is one of the saddest statements that we probably have in the New Testament. We've all been in this kind of situation where you're teaching somebody. Maybe you have a home Bible study. I've been in a lot of situations. The person across the table is shaking his head and agreeing and accepting everything. But then the Bible study ends and there's no response. And weeks go by and finally you realize the person is not going to obey the gospel. But they're real close. And that's a sad situation. That's harder than when people just flat out reject the gospel and turn you away. All right, you go on to someone else. But in a lot of situations, and I know many of you have been there before too, you're real close. Maybe you've even gotten someone to attend services a time or two, and they're real close. And I suppose the lesson is, don't be discouraged by that. That has always been the way it is. We have to just keep trying. Keep preaching the gospel. Continue to look for people who might obey the gospel. And sometimes it just works like that. But almost isn't good enough. And certainly it wasn't the case with Agrippa. And Paul understood that. And Paul responds in a way that I think this is one of my favorite statements in all the New Testament. Notice it says, and Agrippa said to Paul, in a short time you've persuaded me to be a Christian. And Paul said, whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except these chains. I want you to think about that. I have a lesson that I preach sometimes. I haven't preached it here. In fact, it's been a long time since I preached it. But it's called Remember Who You Are. And it is based on, I remember a fella said, and I can't remember if I read it, or if he said it to me. But anyway, his father was a preacher, and he said that he would always, before he left the house, his father would always say to him, remember who you are. It didn't matter where he was going. He was going to school. He was going to play with friends or go to the grocery, whatever. Whenever his father would remember and they were there and he was leaving, they're saying bye, his father would say, remember who you are. That's good advice, isn't it? He's saying, you remember, whatever you're about to do, you remember you're a Christian. And we need to act like that. Wherever we go, you remember that you are a Christian. And so in the sermon, I emphasize some things that we need to, we're Christians. We need to remember that. First of all, with regard to our behavior, whether you're, again, at the bank or someone cuts you off on the freeway or whatever the case is, you have to remember who you are. That's the obvious point. But then I bring out different things from a positive standpoint. We're children of God. We're the elect of God. And those kind of things, we should stop and remember who we are. We don't have to view ourselves as second-class citizens in this society. Most people in the world will be against you. We've talked about that many times. We'll be persecuted, maybe not physically like they were in the first century, but a lot of people, even at the more immoral this country gets and the various issues that arise, the same-sex marriage and abortion and all those kind of things, you stand for the truth. Some people won't like you just because of who you are, just because you're a Christian. But we don't have to hang our heads or anything like that. We should remember who we are. We are blessed people. Some people you know or may associate with or work with, maybe it seems like their life is going more smoothly than yours. Maybe they have more physical stuff than you have, that sort. You don't have to be jealous of that or anything. You are richly blessed as a child of God. And we should remember that. Remember who you are, how blessed you are. And when you think about Paul, it's pretty impressive what he does here. Let's not forget who he's talking to. He's talking to a king. And he's talking to a Roman governor. In fact, we think of the king being more important than a governor. But in this case, the Roman governor actually had more clout than the king. But he's talking to a king and his sister and a Roman governor and all their counselors and all of that. And he says, I would to God that you were like me. that you were in the same state that I'm in. It didn't sound to me like Paul thought, oh, I'm a Christian, poor me. He said, I wish all of you all and everyone, I wish everyone was like me. And it wasn't an arrogant thing. You remember Paul said in one place, I believe it is in the book of Corinthians, he says, I am what I am by what? By the grace of God. And so it wasn't an arrogant thing. And even when we make application of that and we think about people around us and people that we work with and go to school with, we should want them to be like us, to be in the same state that we're in. And it's not an arrogant thing. We should remember with Paul and let whoever we're dealing with, let them know, I am what I am, but by the grace of God. But I've often emphasized, we are what we are by the grace of God, but we are what we are nevertheless. Regardless of why you are who you are and what you are what you are. You're a Christian. You're one who you've had all your sins forgiven. You have a special relationship with God. You're a friend of Jesus Christ. All of that is very significant. There isn't anything higher. There isn't anything more important than those things. And that's who you are. And you should want everyone you come into contact with to be like you, except for maybe the problems that you have to experience. And that's what Paul's saying. I wish everybody was like me, except for these chains. I'm not wishing that everybody was a prisoner like me. But so far as the state of Christianity that I am, that I'm in, I would that not only you, King Agrippa, but everyone here and everyone else was such as I am. And sometimes we just have to stop and think. You know, we have a tendency sometimes to feel sorry for ourselves, to think about our life. And listen, we all have problems. There's not a person here. You have your own personal problem that I don't know anything about. I have my struggles that you don't know anything about. But I know this, we all have them. It's just life. There's another passage over in Hebrews chapter 12 that you're very much familiar with, but I think this is a good passage. The Hebrew writer emphasizes that we sometimes just need to stop and reflect upon how we're thinking about our situation and stop feeling sorry for ourselves. And notice Hebrews chapter 12. Again, you're no doubt familiar with this, but Hebrews 12. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, look at verse 3. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that ye may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggles against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Now, what is he doing here? The Hebrew writer, basically, he's saying, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Run the race of Christianity. Run with patience. Don't quit. Oh, but I'm having these problems. My bills are high. I'm having family issues and marital problems. Just keep running the race. And when you start to feel sorry for yourself, think about Jesus. Because no matter what you or I, no matter what we're going through, we haven't yet resisted to the shedding of blood. We haven't suffered, in other words, like Jesus suffered for us. And sometimes we need to stop and think about that. When real life is happening, just stop feeling, think about what you have. Count your many blessings in Christ and rejoice because of what you have spiritually and even physically. We've all been blessed. And sometimes we need to think about that. Paul was one who suffered tremendously. He had all kinds of problems and difficulties. And yet he still could say, I wish that everyone, all of you were like me, except these chains. And then the king rose and the governor and Bernice and those who were sitting with them. And when they had withdrawn, they said one to another. And here's the common theme throughout this. He said, this man is doing nothing to deserve death or imprisonment. Hadn't that been the constant conclusion with all of this? Over and over, everyone Paul stands before, ultimately, except for the unbelieving Jews who were hypocrites, the leaders, that is. Everyone who has the opportunity to judge him, they hear the case honestly and objectively, and their conclusion is the same. He hadn't done anything wrong. And in fact, Agrippa goes on. Verse 32 says, and Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. And so he of course, is going to have to stand before Caesar. He has made his appeal, and so to Caesar, as Felix said to Caesar, you will go. Festus said to Felix, or to Caesar, you will go. But if not, perhaps they would have set him free. All right, look at chapter 27 then. In chapter 27, now we have Paul finally going to Rome. And Paul, this is basically his dream. We have seen over and over again, Paul emphasized in various places that he wants to go to Rome. Why would Paul want to go to Rome? What's so special about Rome? Yeah, he was a Roman citizen. And that was important. As a Roman citizen, certainly, he would want to go there. But what kind of city was Rome? I mean, when we think about what have we been all through this study and all various studies, when I'm preaching on Romans or whatever, we always emphasize the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire. And of course, Rome is the heart of it all. It's the greatest city on earth. We've emphasized the various cities like Athens we've talked about and Corinth, and what a different city at least. That was a great city, but a lot of immorality there. But Ephesus was fantastic. Alexandria, all kinds of cities that we have talked about and has been mentioned in the book of Acts. But truly, at this particular time, the greatest city of all is Rome. Simply because it's the heart of the Roman Empire. And here Paul, he's an apostle to the Gentiles. But he's never been to the greatest Gentile city on earth. And he yearns to go there. Now over in look over just quickly, Romans chapter 1. Listen to Paul as he writes the epistle even. In Romans, the first chapter, and down at verse 9, he says, Romans 1 at verse 9, he says, for God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will that I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift and strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish, so I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are at Rome. I mean, Paul has had a full life of preaching. He has won hundreds of souls to Christ. He has now established many local congregations in many places, and a lot of it we have read about specifically in the book of Acts. But he's not been to Rome. He hasn't ever preached the gospel in this greatest city on earth. He says, I'm eager to get to you and preach the gospel to you and to other Gentiles. And so he really wanted to go to Rome. It has always been in his plan. Look back over in Acts chapter 19, you remember when he was at Ephesus, and after the riot and all of that he had to endure. Or actually, this is just before that. But as he was there, verse 21, he says, now after these events, Paul resolved in his spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. Now, why did he want to go to Jerusalem? You remember? Huh? Yes, but something even more. Something even more. Very good. Very good. He wanted to get to. He really wanted to go to Jerusalem to give this collection to the saints. And but then after that, he says, after I accomplish that, I want to see Rome. And he indeed went to Jerusalem. That's why we are where we are right now. He went to Jerusalem, and just like the Holy Spirit had warned him, he got in trouble when he was in Jerusalem, and he ended up ultimately as a prisoner in Caesarea and has been there for the past 2 years. But now finally, in chapter 27, we see that Paul is going to Rome. And he's not going the way he wanted to go. And no doubt he wasn't planning on going as a prisoner, but still he's finally on his way to Rome. So chapter 27 at verse 1 says, "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some of the other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius." So he's going to Rome, and it's not just him, but first of all, you notice it says that we should sail for Italy. What does that tell you? Luke is with him. So Luke is making this trip with him. But it also says other prisoners. And it's sort of interesting, that particular word that is used, heteros is the Greek word, and it literally means of a different class or a different kind. And so there's other prisoners, but the prisoners are not like Paul. Paul was innocent. The other prisoners were of a different kind. What does that tell you? They were guilty. These are prisoners that he'll be traveling with are more of the hardened kind. In fact, some of them might be on their way to Rome to be executed. But this is the group that he's going to be traveling with. He's on his way to Rome. And it says, "And embarking in a ship of Adramidium," and Adramidium was, one of the things we learned about that was a city that was on the northwest tip of Asia Minor. And what that tells you, if you can picture in your mind a map of that whole area, that tells us that this ship that they're about to get on is not going to take them to Rome. Because they really have to veer off west and go that way. So what they did in those days, it was almost like hitchhiking. You know, they get in a ship, getting into a boat that will take them so far, but at some point, they're going to have to find themselves another ride. They're going to have to get another ship that is going to go west. But right now, they get on this ship, it says, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia and put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. He was one of the messengers from Thessalonica, you might recall, that was bringing that gift to the poor saints in Jerusalem. And the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and to be cared for. So he's still a Roman citizen who needs to be treated right, and Julius understands all of that, so he treats him very kindly, in a very humane way. Philanthropist is the word there, and it means humane. Be not just kind, but to be humane. And you know, you think about prisoners, and sometimes we treat them, not we, but those who are guards and that sort of thing. Can you, particularly if these are hardened prisoners, they're criminals, can you be real nice to them? You got to be tough sometimes, don't you? You got to be forceful sometimes. And you know, guards generally are quite mean to these prisoners because they're dealing with people who are dangerous. But there's a fine line of being tough and being forceful and being abusive. And sometimes prisoners are treated in an inhumane fashion, but not Paul. He's being treated gently. He's being treated in a humane fashion. He's even allowed to leave and go to his friends. We don't know who those friends is. Maybe they were Christians. Maybe they weren't. He's been to Sidon quite a bit, at least on two occasions we've seen in the book of Acts, him go through there. Maybe he's established a church there. We don't know. But they're friends, and they were able to care for him. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. And the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. So they got themselves another ride, didn't they? They got themselves a ship that was going west. And so that's what they get on, this ship of Alexandria. And so that would take them where they need to go. And we sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulties off of Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete off of Simone, coasting along it with difficulty. We came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. Now, I don't know if we have time, perhaps we do, but you notice here, they come to Fair Havens, and the sailing situation isn't very good at all. It's the time of year that sailing was very dangerous. And they had marked times when people were warned that they shouldn't be sailing, particularly in the Mediterranean Sea. From September the 10th, I believe it is, to November 11th, it was called the dangerous time. It was very dangerous. From November 11th to March, I believe it is, March 10th, I think, the sea was closed down. They wouldn't allow sailing in the sea at that time because it was just far too dangerous. But at that first period, the dangerous time, they'd let you sail, but you'd have to be motivated to get into to sail in the Mediterranean at this particular time. And you notice here that as we read on, it says verse 9, and since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them. Now the fast is talking about the Day of Atonement. That was the only time that the Jews were commanded to fast, on the Day of Atonement. And the Day of Atonement was right in the middle of this dangerous season. So we know now that this was a bad time to be sailing in the Mediterranean Sea. And we'll pick it up next week. But Paul is going to be telling them, hey, let's stay here at Fair Havens. Wasn't a very nice place, but let's stay here. And, of course, you've read the story many times before. We'll go over it. They decide, no, let's go. They got themselves in trouble. And so we'll see Paul in the shipwreck next week. Appreciate your attention.